Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and joining me today are my diplomat colleagues, Prashant Parameswaran and Shannon Tiezi. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Today, we're just going to discuss a few topics that have come up in the Asia-Pacific recently, as is tradition on the podcast. But before we actually get into that, we want to introduce something new that we're doing here at The Diplomat, which is we've just launched a new interview series called Diplomatic Access, which offers our readers a great window into the minds of Asia's top diplomats in Washington, D.C. I'll actually pass it over to Shannon to kind of explain more about this and, you know, what this is all about.
Sure. So this is a new project that we're doing, and I think we've done stuff like this in the past, but it's been a couple of years, so we decided it was a good idea to dust it off and bring it back out. We are trying to interview as many ambassadors as possible from the Asia-Pacific region as the diplomat defines it, which is a little broader than the general definition, so including South Asia, Central Asia as well. And we are doing both written and video interviews. We should have our first video one going up next week, which we're excited about. And something for diplomat readers to keep an eye on as you're going through these interviews is we did ask every single ambassador who's participating the same two questions to start out with. The first question is, from your country's perspective, what are the major security threats to the region? And the second question is, what can we do to address these threats? So that's something to keep in mind as you're going through these interviews and looking at them. It's really interesting to compare and see what these different countries think are the major security threats and what solutions they propose for dealing with them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I actually want to devote some time on this podcast to discussing the first interview, which is with the ambassador of Mongolia. I thought that was a fascinating interview. Mongolia is really a country that kind of gets overlooked when you're talking about the Northeast Asian region. You know, you have South Korea, Japan, North Korea, and China, all, you know, big ticket countries. But Mongolia is there. It's sandwiched right there between Russia and China and has an appetite for a big diplomatic role in the region. So Shannon, I guess Prashant, both of you, I mean, what struck you about this interview with a Mongolian diplomat? I have one thing I want to get to later, but I wanted to give you guys a chance to kind of start this discussion.
I think the one thing that's probably of the most immediate interest and might be surprising to people is how Mongolia is more involved than a lot of people realize in the whole Korean nuclear problem. They have a pretty good relationship with both North and South Korea. And unlike other countries, like, for example, China also has a good relationship with both countries, Mongolia isn't seen as being partial to one or the other. So that really makes them a very valuable player, a valuable source of interaction, and even possibly to work in some sense as a mediator between these two countries, because they have hosted officials from both North and South Korea at the same time before. So that's definitely something I would pay attention to. Go check out the interview and see what the ambassador has to say about that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And Prashant?
Yeah, I mean, I would say definitely agree with Shannon on the fact that Mongolia is a lot more actively involved than people think. And I think the ambassador does a really good job of going into both at the official and then the track two aspects of Mongolia's involvement internationally. I do think it's also, you know, interesting. I mean, Mongolian diplomats will always mention sort of their sort of third neighbor policy or outlook, which is really interesting because that also brings to mind Japan, which is also an increasing partner for Mongolia. And I think the two countries just signed an economic partnership agreement. I think that was last month, and it's going to come into effect soon. So this idea of being sandwiched, as you said, Ankit, between Russia and China, and sort of trying to both play a balancing role between these various countries, but then also use that as leverage to promote itself in the broader region. So cementing ties between other countries like the United States and Japan, that's really important to Mongolia's foreign policy outlook. And I think that was something that came across very clearly in the interview.
Yeah, You know, like something I wrote quite a bit about last year is just how activist of a country Mongolia is when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, especially compared to its weight. I mean, it's a fairly, you know, low population country. It's based, it has a mineral and natural resource based economy. But yet, you know, as you point out, it's quite, you know, it's everywhere. I think a lot of the credit for that actually goes to a Mongolia's president, Sakhalin Elbegdorj, I hope I pronounced that right, who has been, and, you know, he's been a globetrotter. I mean, he's increased strategic ties with the United States, both in terms of security and economics. He's increased ties with European countries, particularly when it comes to natural resource development within their own country. With Russia and China, Mongolia is now part of a trilateral process there, as you've both pointed out, also on the Korean Peninsula. Mongolia also has close ties with Japan and Southeast Asia. I mean, Mongolia is really quite a dynamic country diplomatically. And I think, you know, like I said in the beginning, it gets overlooked. And I think it's a country worth paying attention to if you're interested in, you know, knowing the Asia-Pacific. So, you know, this Diplomatic Access series is going to be something we'll be promoting quite heavily on Diplomat, so definitely keep an eye out for the future interviews. We do have a very interesting interview with the Pakistani ambassador, but unfortunately we're not going to devote time on the podcast to that because, you know, it is a completely separate topic, and I think it merits a separate discussion, so maybe we can do that on a separate podcast. Now we'll just move into our regular discussion of some of the recent topics that have come up in the Asia-Pacific. I want to focus with the events taking place on the border between China and Myanmar in China's Yunnan province in southeastern China. As Diplomat readers will be aware, last week Myanmar's Air Force accidentally bombed a Chinese sugarcane field in Yunnan province and killed 4 people and injured 9 others. One of the 9 injured actually ended up passing away later, bringing the total death toll to 5. Obviously, this is a very serious incident. The conflict going on in Myanmar right now between the Kokang rebels, who are ethnically Chinese, and the Myanmar armed forces is escalating. It's resulting in a refugee crisis for China. Thousands of ethnic Chinese, primarily ethnic Chinese refugees from Myanmar, are coming into Yunnan province. So as I wrote last week, this does test the limits of China's non-interference policy, which has been a major pillar of its foreign policy under its 5 principles, which have historically driven its policy. But this is definitely something to watch. Shannon, what's your take here on China's response? Also, maybe you can go a bit into the actual Chinese response, the comments by Fan Chanlong, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think all things considered, China has actually had a very moderate response. As you mentioned, this is an incredibly serious incident. This is a foreign government dropping bombs on Chinese soil and killing Chinese citizens. That is an incredibly serious thing to have happen. And of course, China has responded, taking this as seriously as it deserves to be taken. You had Fan Chenglong say, you know, if this is going to become a trend, we're going to need to take decisive action. And you have the government pushing for Myanmar to apologize and pay compensation to the family members, which recent reports suggest that they're going to do. But at first, you had the Myanmar government basically deny that they were responsible. They tried to blame this on the ethnic rebels and said that they had launched bombs into China because the rebels don't have aircraft, so they couldn't have dropped them from a plane, as the bomb appears to have been dropped. And China's foreign ministry and defense ministry basically came back and said, no, like flat out, no, that's not what happened. Your Air Force dropped this. Your Air Force has been routinely violating our airspace. And it's important to note that this wasn't the first incident of a bomb from the Myanmar Air Force being dropped in Chinese territory. It was the first one that actually resulted in casualties. The previous one, the bomb landed on empty ground. Fortunately, no one was injured or killed. So the Chinese government is basically, they're not interfering. So I think they're very strongly keeping their policy of non-interference intact, but they are taking all possible measures to make sure this doesn't happen again. They've dispatched extra forces to the border, including their own Chinese Air Force, which seems to be more or less tailing the planes from Myanmar as they get close to the border, sort of acting as a warning, okay, you're coming close to our territory, you better watch yourself.
Yeah, definitely. you know, one of the issues that I've been sort of concerned about is the nationalist backlash within China. Because, you know, when it comes to China's rise as a superpower, you do have a huge nationalist contingent within China that's eager to see China behave as a strong player on the international stage. You know, after its century of humiliation, China is now strong and powerful. It can respond to countries that would threaten it. So if we do see repeats of similar incidents, do you think that the nationalist impulse within China will grow to a point where Xi Jinping and the senior leadership in the Politburo are forced to seriously think about kinetic action, if not, you know, if not due to strategic needs, primarily because of the rising nationalist tide at home?
Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting question about nationalism as a double-edged sword, and I would encourage anyone who's really interested and wants to go in depth in this topic to pick up the book Powerful Patriots by Jessica Chen Weiss. We ran an interview with her on The Diplomat a couple of months ago, but she really gets into this topic, which is people often think about the government purposely fomenting nationalism so that it can use these protests to back up its position, notably, you know, when it wants something from Japan. But there's a flip side to that, which is these nationalist strains sometimes come out in areas where Beijing does not want them. And there was a very angry backlash to this online. You know, Chinese people were understandably outraged that another country had bombed their territory and killed Chinese citizens. And the government in these instances, they're very experienced about tamping down on sentiments that they don't want, about preventing protests from breaking out. And in this sort of instance, they turn that on the patriots themselves, on the nationalist forces that are getting out of hand. And one other tactic that we didn't see in this instant, but that has been used before, is the government simply delayed media coverage. When you had those anti-Chinese riots in Vietnam that ended up, you know, killing, injuring, you know, burning factories, they simply didn't cover it in the media for a few days until things had calmed down a little bit, until the Vietnamese government had already had a very contrite response that they could then pair with the story. So if things really start to get out of hand, that might be what we see, is the government cracking down on this nationalist sentiment. Because I think it's pretty clear that Xi Jinping and company do not want to have to become militarily involved in this conflict that's going on in Myanmar.
Right, right. That's actually very good to hear. I mean, in a certain way, I mean, you know, the worry is that nationalism escalates and forces the hand of the leadership. But fortunately, I think the political circumstances being what they are in China, we have the opposite. We have the government actually pushing back against these nationalist impulses. Anyways, I do kind of want to move on. Before we move on, Prashant, you know, as our Southeast Asia focused editor, is there anything you want to add about sort of Myanmar's response to this? And, you know, if you think that the Myanmar government is you know, at a crossroads right now in its fight against the Kokang rebels?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with what Shannon said and what you said in general. I mean, I think the Chinese have reacted pretty moderately in terms of the contrast between the what they've said in terms of the rhetoric and how they've actually acted. I would just add that this whole border issue is extremely murky. So instances like this have happened over the past couple of years involving the Kokang rebels, previously as well. And the main question that people have is, you know, what is the degree of Chinese involvement, whether it's arming these rebels, whether it's encouraging them to foment instability, whether it's trying to preserve some kind of strategic influence in Myanmar. And the reality is it's very difficult to tell because these Kokang rebels, some of them are ethnic Chinese and they have links across the border. There's a lot of illicit trade that goes across the border. It's a porous border. So it's very difficult to ascertain, you know, is this something, is the assistance or is there any guidance coming from the Chinese central leadership, which I don't think is very likely. But to the extent that you see connections or sort of cross-border movements between China and Myanmar, that's actually fairly common. So when you're dealing with issues like, you know, non-interference and the idea of, you know, what is the degree of Chinese complicity, these are actually very murky issues. And I think this instance clearly proves that when you have such a murky situation, you can have it go out of control very quickly and both sides will want to deny it. So the Burmese will say, well, you know, we think it's the ethnic groups. You know, it's not us. It's not the government. And the Chinese will say, no, it's not the central government. You know, it's just a bunch of local forces who are doing this. They're doing it behind our back. We're not responsible. So it's very difficult to actually come to a conclusion as to the degree of responsibility. So.
Yeah.
And one other point that might be of interest in considering this is the Myanmar government has said before that these ethnic rebels are actually retreating into Chinese territory. And obviously, as Prashant was saying, that there's a huge question mark there over whether the local governments even know that this is happening, much less the central government. But that might explain why you're having Myanmar's Air Force fly over Chinese territory, if they believe that they're actually following the rebels that they're targeting, and the rebels have crossed into Chinese territory. It does become a very murky issue then.
Yeah, just one final thing I want to mention is in the recent anti-corruption campaign against the PLA, one senior PLA official at the PLA Military Academy, I believe, was, you know, found guilty or, you know, pushed out after he was found guilty of leaking state secrets to these rebels. So that, again, you know, adds a little bit of credibility to Myanmar's position that there are elements within China, within the Chinese government and the military establishment that are actively backing these rebels.
Mm-hmm. That obviously, but at the same time, the fact that he was basically ousted from his position because of that shows that the higher-ups, the top leaders, aren't okay with this.
Right, definitely.
I'm sure there are always going to be unorthodox actors, especially at the local level, as Prashant was saying. You know, people travel back and forth. They have family on both sides. It's hard to control that. But the government's trying to send a message to the other top leaders, the military officials. This isn't okay. And we're going to make an example of this guy so that hopefully other people won't follow in his footsteps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. So yeah, we'll be keeping a close eye on this at The Diplomat. We're obviously very interested in the possibility of a conflict breaking out between China and another country. So, you know, we'll, hopefully it doesn't come to that. Hopefully we don't see a repeat of this sort of an incident, but this is turning into an unexpected flashpoint. So Prashant, talk to us a bit about the South China Sea. Obviously it's been a busy week in the South China Sea related to those issues, you know, almost all weeks are. So we had a lot of issues come up recently. The Philippines had a rebuttal for China at the International Court. The ASEAN defense ministers had a security declaration, which drew criticism from China again. So why don't we start with the security declaration, actually? Do you want to just fill us in on the details of that and why it's a significant issue?
Sure. So the security declaration, basically, I mean, as always, when these ASEAN defense ministers meet, they will sort of issue a document where they'll say, these are the priorities that we've endorsed, and these are the things that we're going to move forward on. And this year is a particularly important year because it's the sort of year of the formation of the ASEAN community by the end of 2015. And Malaysia, as a founding member of ASEAN, is chairing the organization. A lot of the proposals within the security declaration that was issued after the ADMM were focused on regional security proposals. So there was mention, for example, of a ready group on humanitarian exercises and disaster relief cooperation, for example. But as usual, the South China Sea does get some mention, and that's something which the international media picked up on from the statement, but then also subsequently after the ASEAN defense ministers meeting, at a panel discussion, the head of the 7th Fleet at the Langkawi exhibition that was held, you know, shortly after the meeting, suggested that Southeast Asian states should form joint patrols in the South China Sea.
How realistic is that in your view?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting idea, but I think we're a long way off from that. I mean, in order for those patrols to happen, the first thing you need is the same sort of perception of threat from various Southeast Asian claimants, and then for them to have the same response in terms of how they deal with it. And, you know, unfortunately, even though Southeast Asian countries have come increasingly together over the last few years because they're worried about the situation in the South China Sea, including China's assertiveness there, I still don't think that there's a consensus on how to approach the issue in terms of very forward reaching proposals like joint patrols. I mean, it's one thing to talk about joint patrols when you're talking about eradicating piracy in the Straits of Malacca, but it's another thing to talk about, you know, doing it in the South China Sea. I mean, I guess conceptually it's also a little bit controversial, but in practice, just think about, you know, how it would work. I mean, if you have disputed waters and disputed territories, where would the actual patrols be at, and who would be responsible for that? And would Southeast Asian countries want to take responsibility, you know, should any tensions arise there? So, I mean, it's an interesting proposal. I'm just not sure what the specifics would be. I mean, it got some support from the Philippines. But so far, the other countries have been more keen to emphasize non-traditional security issues, including Malaysia, for that matter, and sort of downplay the deployment of joint patrols, at least in the immediate future. So we'll see how that plays out.
Do you think that suggestion sort of betrays a hole in the U.S. strategic approach to the issue of the South China Sea? I mean, making a suggestion like this just really makes it seem like the United States, as it's rebalancing to Asia and thinking about the future of the South China Sea, really sees this as a dispute between two parties instead of a dispute between multiple parties. You know, the idea that, you know, a naval official could make a suggestion like this almost, you know, as an off-the-cuff remark and think it to be something reasonable and within reach, I think that to me suggests, like, you know, there's a gap in understanding where these Southeast Asian states are right now with their understanding of South China Sea disputes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always a tendency for certain officials in any government to sort of, you get a question from a reporter or you're speaking about a potential proposal and you say, oh, you know, perhaps this could happen. And then, you know, one, news outlet picks it up and then becomes news suggesting that U.S. policy has changed. Now, I don't think it's fair to say that the United States itself wants to endorse this as an idea and wants all the ASEAN states to come together. But I think, you know, it definitely shows the degree, if anything, I think it shows the degree to which the United States expects and wants ASEAN to work together as a united front, potentially against external threats such as China. It wants ASEAN to be there. But unfortunately, the reality is on the ground, Southeast Asian states, even though they agree about certain positions in the South China Sea, including, you know, they do condemn unilateral changes to the status quo, some of the Chinese behavior is concerning, they don't all want to respond in a very far-reaching way anytime soon. And there's actually some disagreements about how to move forward beyond, you know, the conventional things like implementing the Declaration of the Code of Conduct, concluding a code of conduct with China. Some of these far-reaching, sort of security measures like joint patrols is where you see some ASEAN states become more comfortable and others sort of less comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this whole idea with patrols has been kind of a refrain in statements by U.S. Leaders recently. You know, there was that whole story with I think a U.S. official made a comment that they wanted to see, they would welcome Japanese patrols in the South China Sea.
Yeah, it was actually the same official, yeah.
Oh, was it? Okay, that's an interesting point. All right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, the United States is obviously unwilling to commit its own resources to patrolling the South China Sea for obvious reasons. Obviously, it's a very provocative move in the competition with China. But yeah, this is something that I think, you know, ASEAN will have to think about in the future. I mean, the one country I think actually that would be maybe open to this would be Vietnam. I'm actually surprised that the Philippines was more receptive to this since, you know, they have their whole legal process going right now, and that's kind of their chosen venue since they acknowledge their conventional maritime weaknesses vis-a-vis China. But who else? I mean, can you just, I guess, you know, very briefly, could you walk through, you know, what other countries you think might be open to a proposal like this? Malaysia, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason why the Philippines, I think it was very easily for them to sort of say, well, you know, we're open to the idea, is because the United States has been actually helping the Philippines because, the Philippines is a treaty ally of the United States. So the United States has been providing them with equipment and also, you know, aircraft to help them patrol their surrounding waters. So this is something, you know, it's not a joint patrol with Southeast Asian countries, but something, you know, involving assistance of patrols is already something that the Philippines is looking to.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, you know, with Vietnam, given the fact that they're trying to balance a lot of their relationships this year being a very important year in the U.S.-Vietnam relationship, but also a very important year in the South China Sea, they would be a little bit more on the fence relative to the Philippines, obviously, because of their diversified set of relationships.
Right.
But on Malaysia's, from Malaysia's perspective, I think there's a real hesitancy in Kuala Lumpur to sort of, if possible, they want to prevent any sort of flashpoints with China that would destabilize the relationship. I think the focus very much has been on trying to improve the economic relationship. Last year, the economic relationship took a little bit of a hit because of some decline in tourism arrivals, but also, you know, the MH370 incident was hovering over the relationship as well. So there's a real inclination to improve the economic side of things. So to the extent that the South China Sea poses an irritant to that, I would think that there will be a lot of hesitancy and caution moving forward with more far-reaching proposals like this, beyond sort of the usual, you know, we want a code of conduct with China to be concluded, and we're going to play a constructive role in that, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. So just to provide context for our listeners here, I just looked up the quote because I was curious. So this was Vice Admiral Robert Thomas of the U.S. 7th Fleet, and what he said is that if ASEAN members were to take the lead in organizing something along the lines of a joint patrol, trust me, the U.S. 7th Fleet would be ready to support. So that, again, you know, kind of leaves some questions open. What does support mean? Is that material support, you know, moral support, or political support? Anyways, that's all the time we have on the podcast today. Thanks a lot, Shannon and Prashant, for joining me and providing your incredible insight on China and Southeast Asia. And obviously, listeners, just keep an eye out for future coverage of these issues over at The Diplomat. And definitely keep an eye out for our Diplomatic Access series. You'll see that on Twitter and Facebook coming up in the next few weeks. Thanks for listening.